box. Then he picked the box up by the pistol grip. There was a knob at the back, facing him, and a graduated dial. Dodgson said, "Batteries charged?"
"They're charged," King said.
"Okay," Dodgson said. "I'll go first into the nest area. I'll adjust the box and get rid of the animals. You two follow behind me, and once the animals are gone, you each take an egg from the nest. Then you leave and bring them back to the car. I'll come back last. Then we all drive off. Got it?"
"Right," Basilton said.
"Okay," King said.
"What kind of dinosaurs are these?"
"I have no fucking idea," Dodgson said, climbing out of the car. "And it doesn't make any difference. Just follow the procedure." He closed the door softly. The others got out quietly, and they started forward down the wet trail. Their feet squished in the mud. The sound from the clearing continued. To Dodgson, it sounded like a lot of animals. He pushed aside the last of the ferns and saw them. It was a large nesting site with perhaps 4 or 5 low earthen mounds covered in grasses. The mounds were about 7 feet wide and 3 feet deep. There were 20 beige-colored adults around the mounds, a whole herd of dinosaurs surrounding the nesting site. And the adults were big, 30 feet long and 10 feet high, all honking and snorting.
"Oh my God," Basilton said, staring.
Dodgson shook his head.
"They're myosaurs," he whispered. "This is going to be a piece of cake."
Myosaurs had been named by paleontologist Jack Horner. Before Horner, scientists assumed that dinosaurs abandoned their eggs, as most reptiles did. Those assumptions fitted the old picture of dinosaurs as cold-blooded reptilian creatures. Like reptiles, they were thought to be solitary. Murals on museum walls rarely showed more than one example from each species. A brontosaurus here, a stegosaurus or a triceratops there, wading through the swamps. But Horner's excavations in the badlands of Montana provided clear, unambiguous evidence that at least one species of hadrosaurs had engaged in complex nesting and parenting behavior. Horner incorporated that behavior in the name he gave these creatures. Myosaur meant good mother lizard. Watching them now, Dodgson could see the myosaurs were indeed attentive parents, the big adults circling the nests, moving carefully to step outside the shallow earthen mounds. The beige myosaurs were duck-billed dinosaurs. They had large heads that ended in a broad, flattened snout, rather like the bill of a duck. They were taking mouthfuls of grass and dropping it on the eggs in the mounds. This was, he knew, a way to regulate the temperature of the eggs. If the huge animals sat on the eggs, they would crush them. So instead, they put a layer of grass over the eggs, which trapped heat and kept the eggs at a more constant temperature. The animals worked steadily.
"They're huge," Basilton said.
"They're nothing but oversized cows," Dodgson said. Although the myosaurs were large, they were plant eaters, and they had the docile, slightly stupid manner of cows.
"Ready? Here we go."
He lifted the box like a gun and stepped forward into view. Dodgson expected a big reaction when the myosaurs saw him, but there was none at all. They hardly seemed to notice him. One or two adults looked over, stared with dumb eyes, and then looked away. The animals continued to drop grass on the eggs, which were pale white, spherical, and nearly 2 feet long. Each was about twice the size of an ostrich egg, about the size of a small beach ball. No animals had hatched yet. King and Basilton stepped out and stood beside him in the clearing. Still, the myosaurs ignored them.
"Amazing," Basilton said.
"Fine for us," Dodgson said, and he turned on the box. A continuous, high-pitched shriek filled the clearing. The Mayasaurs immediately turned toward the sound, honking and lifting their heads. They seemed agitated, confused. Dodgson twisted the dial, and the shriek became higher, ear-splitting. The Mayasaurs bobbed their heads and moved away from the painful sound. They clustered at the far end of the clearing. Several of the animals urinated in alarm. A few of them moved away into the foliage, abandoning the nest. They were agitated, but they stayed away. "Go now," Dodgson said. King stepped into the nearest nest and grunted as he picked up an egg. His arms hardly reached around the huge oval. The Mayasaurs honked at him, but none of the adults moved forward. Then Basilton went into the nest, took an egg, and followed King back to the car. Dodgson walked backward, holding the box on the adults. At the edge of the clearing, he turned the sound off. At once the Mayasaurs came back, honking loudly and repeatedly. But as they returned to the nests, it seemed as if the adults forgot what had just happened. Within a few moments, they ceased honking and went back to dropping grass over the eggs. They ignored Dodgson as he left and headed back along the game trail. "Stupid animals," Dodgson thought as he went to the car. Basilton and King were setting the eggs into big styrofoam containers in the back and fitting the foam packing around them carefully. Both men were grinning like kids. "That was amazing."
"Great. Fantastic."
"What did I tell you?" Dodgson said. "Nothing to it." He glanced at his watch. "At this rate, we'll finish in less than 4 hours." He climbed behind the steering wheel and turned on the engine. Basilton got into the back seat. King got in the passenger seat and took out the map. "Next," Dodgson said. The High Hide.
"I tell you, it's fine," Levine said irritably. He was sweating in the stifling heat beneath the aluminum roof of the High Hide. "Look, it didn't even break the skin."
He held out his hand. There was a red semicircle where the compi had pressed its teeth into the skin, but that was all. Beside him, Eddie said,
"Yeah, well, your ear is bleeding a little."
"I don't feel anything. It can't be bad."
"No, it's not bad," Eddie said, opening the first aid kit. "But I better clean it up."
"I prefer," Levine said, "to get on with my observations."
The dinosaurs were barely a quarter mile away from him, and he could see them well. In the still midday air, he could hear them breathe.
He could hear them breathe.
Or at least he could, if this young man would leave him alone.
"Look," Levine said, "I know what I'm doing here. You came in at the end of a very interesting and successful experiment. I actually called the dinosaurs to me by imitating their cry."
"You did?" Eddie said.
"Yes, I did. That was what led them into the forest in the first place. So I hardly think that I need your assistance."
"The thing is," Eddie said, "you got some of that dino shit on your ear, and there's a couple of little punctures. I'll just clean it off for you."
He soaked a gauze pad with disinfectant.
"May sting a little."
"I don't care. I have other..."
"Ow!"
"Stop moving," Eddie said. "It'll only take a second."
"It's absolutely unnecessary.
If you just stand still, it'll be done."
"There."
He took the gauze away. Levine saw brown and a faint streak of red. Just as he suspected, the injury was trivial. He reached up and touched his ear. It didn't hurt at all. Levine squinted out at the plane as Eddie packed up the first aid case.
"Geez, it's hot up here," Eddie said.
"Yes," Levine said, shrugging.
"Sarah Harding arrived, and I think they took her back to the trailer.
You want to go back now?"
"I can't imagine why," Levine said.
"I just thought you might want to say hello or something," Eddie said.
"My work is here," Levine said.
He turned away, raised his binoculars to his eyes.
So, Eddie said, you don't want to come back?
Wouldn't dream of it, Levine said, staring through binoculars.
Not in a million years. Not in 65 million years.
Trailer. Kelly Curtis listened to the sound of the shower. She couldn't believe it. She stared at the muddy clothes tossed casually on the bed. Shorts and a khaki short-sleeve shirt. Sarah Harding's actual clothes. She couldn't help it. Kelly reached out and touched them. She noticed how the fabric was worn and frayed. Buttons sewn back on. They didn't match. And there were some reddish streaks near the pocket that she thought must be old bloodstains. She reached down and touched the fabric. Kelly? Sarah was calling to her from the shower.
She remembered my name.
Yes, Kelly said, her voice betraying her nervousness. Is there any shampoo?
I'll look, Dr. Harding, Kelly said, opening drawers hastily.
The men had all gone into the next compartment, leaving her alone with Sarah while she washed. Kelly searched desperately, opening the drawers, slamming them shut again.
Listen, Sarah called. It's okay if you can't find any.
I'm looking.
Is there any dishwashing liquid?
Kelly paused. There was a green plastic bottle by the sink.
Yes, Dr. Harding, but give it to me. It's all the same stuff. I don't care.
The hand reached out past the shower curtain. Kelly handed it to her.
And my name is Sarah.
Okay, Dr. Harding.
Sarah.
Okay, Sarah.
Sarah Harding was a regular person. Very informal and normal. Entranced, Kelly sat on the seat in the kitchen and waited, swinging her feet in case Dr. Harding, Sarah, needed anything else. She listened to Sarah humming, I'm gonna wash that man right out of my hair. After a few moments, the shower turned off, and her hand reached out and took the towel on the hook. And then she came out, wrapped in the towel. Sarah ran her fingers through her short hair, which seemed to be all the attention she gave to her appearance.
That feels better.
Boy, this is a plush field trailer. Doc really did a great job.
Yes, she said. It's nice.
She smiled at Kelly.
How old are you, Kelly?
13.
What is that, 8th grade?
7th.
7th grade, Sarah said thoughtfully.
Kelly said, Dr. Malcolm left some clothes for you.
He said he thought they'd fit.
She pointed to a clean pair of shorts and a t-shirt.
Whose are these?
I think they're Eddie's.
Sarah held them up.
Might work.
She took them around the corner, into the sleeping area, and started getting dressed. She said, what are you going to do when you grow up?
I don't know, Kelly said.
That's a very good answer.
It is?
Kelly's mother was always pushing her to get a part-time job, to decide what she wanted to do with her life.
Yes,
Sarah said. Nobody smart knows what they want to do until they get into their 20s or 30s.
Oh.
What do you like to study?
Actually, I like math, she said in a sort of guilty voice.
Sarah must have heard her tone because she said, what's wrong with math?
Well,
girls aren't good at it. I mean, you know. No, I don't know. Sarah's voice was flat. Kelly felt panic. She had been experiencing this warm feeling with Sarah Harding, but now she sensed it was dissolving away, as if she had given a wrong answer to a disapproving teacher. She decided not to say anything else. She waited in silence. After a moment, Sarah came out again, wearing Eddie's baggy clothes. She sat down and started putting on a pair of boots. She moved in a very normal, matter-of-fact way.
What did you mean, girls aren't good at mathematics?
Well, that's what everybody says.
Everybody like who?
My teachers.
Sarah sighed. Great, she said, shaking her head. Your teachers. And the other kids call me a brainer. Stuff like that. You know.
Kelly just blurted it out. She couldn't believe that she was saying all this to Sarah Harding, whom she hardly knew at all except from articles and pictures. But here she was, telling her all this personal stuff. All these things that upset her.
Sarah just smiled cheerfully. Well, if they say that, you must be pretty good at math, huh?
I guess.
She smiled.
That's wonderful, Kelly.
But the thing is, boys don't like girls who are too smart.
Sarah's eyebrows went up.
Is that so?
Well, that's what everybody says.
Like who?
Like my mom.
Uh-huh. And she probably knows what she's talking about.
I don't know, Kelly admitted. My mom only dates jerks, actually.
So she could be wrong? Sarah asked, glancing up at Kelly as she tied her laces.
I guess.
Well, in my experience, some men like smart women and some don't.
It's like everything else in the world.
She stood up.
You know about George Schaller?
Sure.
He studied pandas.
Right. Pandas. And before that, snow leopards and lions and gorillas. He's the most important animal researcher in the 20th century.
And you know how he works?
Kelly shook her head. Before he goes into the field, George reads everything that's ever been written about the animal he's going to study. Popular books, newspaper accounts, scientific papers, everything. Then he goes out and observes the animal for himself. And you know what he usually finds?
She shook her head, not trusting herself to speak.
That nearly everything that's been written or said is wrong.
Like the gorilla.
George studied mountain gorillas 10 years before Diane Fossey ever thought of it. And he found that what was believed about gorillas was exaggerated, or misunderstood, or just plain fantasy. Like the idea that you couldn't take women on gorilla expeditions because the gorillas would rape them.
Wrong.
Everything.
Just.
Wrong. Sarah finished tying her boots and stood. So, Kelly, even at your young age, there's something you might as well learn now. All your life, people will tell you things. And most of the time, probably 95% of the time, what they'll tell you will be wrong.
Kelly said nothing. She felt oddly disheartened to hear this.
It's a fact of life, Sarah said. Human beings are just stuffed full of misinformation. So it's hard to know who to believe.
I know how you feel.
You do?
Sure. My mom used to tell me I'd never amount to anything.
She smiled.
So did some of my professors.
Really?
It didn't seem possible.
Oh, yes, Sarah said. As a matter of fact...
From the other section of the trailer, they heard Malcolm say, No. No! Those idiots! They could ruin everything!
Sarah immediately turned and went into the other section. Kelly jumped off the seat and hurried after her. The men were all clustered around the monitor. Everyone was talking at once, and they seemed to be upset.
This is terrible, Malcolm was saying.
Terrible!
Thorne said, Is that a jeep?
They had a red jeep, Harding said, coming up to look.
Then it's Dodgson, Malcolm said.
Damn!
What's he doing here?
I can guess.
Kelly pushed through to get a look. On the screen, she saw foliage and intermittent flashes of a red and black vehicle.
Where are they now? Malcolm said to Arby. I think they're in the East Valley, Arby said, near where we found Dr. Levine.
The radio clicked. Levine's voice said, Do you mean there are now other people on the island?
Yes, Richard.
Well, you better go stop them before they mess everything up.
I know. Do you want to come back? Not without a compelling reason. Inform me if one arises.
And his radio clicked off.
Harding stared at the screen, watching the Jeep. That's them, all right, she said. That's your friend Dodgson.
He's not my friend, Malcolm said. He got up, wincing in pain from his leg.
Let's go, he said. We have to stop these bastards. There's no time to waste. Nest. The red Jeep Wrangler rolled softly to a stop. Directly ahead was a wall of dense foliage, but through it they could see sunlight from the clearing beyond. Dodgson sat quietly in the car, listening. King turned to him, about to speak, but Dodgson held up his hand, gesturing to him to be silent. Then he heard it clearly. A low rumbling growl, almost a purr. It was coming from beyond the foliage ahead. It sounded like the biggest jungle cat he had ever heard. And intermittently, he felt a slight vibration. Hardly anything, but enough to make the car keys clink against the steering column. As he felt that vibration, it slowly dawned on him. It's walking. Something very big. Walking. Beside him, King was staring forward in astonishment. His mouth hung open. Dodgson glanced back at Basilton. The professor was gripping the seat with white fingers as he listened to the sound. A shadow moved across the ferns directly ahead. Judging by the shadow, the animal was 20 feet high and 40 feet long. It walked on its hind legs and had a large body, a short neck, a very big head. A tyrannosaur. Dodgson hesitated, staring at the shadow. His heart was pounding in his chest. He considered going on to the next nest, but he was confident that the box would work here, too. He said, Let's get this over with. Give me the box. Basilton handed him the box, just as he had done before. Dodgson said, Charged? Batteries are charged, King said.
Okay, he said. Here we go. Exactly the same as before. I'll go first, you two follow, and bring the eggs back to the car. Ready?
Ready, Basilton said.
King did not answer. He was still staring at the shadow.
What kind of a dinosaur is that?
That's a Tyrannosaurus.
Oh, Jesus, King said.
A Tyrannosaurus, Basilton said.
It doesn't matter what it is, Dodgson said irritably. Just follow the plan like before.
Everybody ready?
Just a minute, Basilton said.
King said, What if it doesn't work?
We already know it works, Dodgson said.
There's a rather curious fact about tyrannosaurs that was recently reported, Basilton said. A paleontologist named Roxton did a study of the tyrannosaur brain case and concluded that they have a brain not much different from a frog's, although of course much bigger. The implication was their nervous systems were adapted to motion only. They can't see you if you stand still. Stationary objects become invisible to them.
Are you sure about that? King said.
Basilton said, That was the report. And it makes perfect sense. One can't forget that dinosaurs, for all their intimidating size, were actually rather primitive intellects. It's quite logical that a tyrannosaur would have the mental equipment of a frog.
I don't see why we're rushing into this, King said nervously.
He stared forward.
It's much bigger than the other ones.
So what? Dodgson said. You heard what George said. It's just a big frog. Let's get it done. Get out of the fucking car. And don't slam the doors.
George Basleton had felt quite good and authoritative, recalling that obscure article from the journals. He had been in his accustomed role, dispensing information to people who lacked it. Now that he approached the nest, he was astonished to notice that his knees had begun to tremble. His legs felt like rubber. He had always thought that was a figure of speech. He was alarmed to realize it could be literally true. He bit his lip and forced himself under control. He was not, he told himself, going to show fear. He was the master of this situation. Dodgson was already moving ahead, holding the black box like a gun in his hand. Basleton glanced over at King, who was deathly pale and sweating. He looked on the verge of collapse. He moved forward slowly. Basleton walked alongside him, making sure he was all right. Up ahead, Dodgson gave a final glance back, waved to Basleton and King to catch up. He glared at both of them, and then he stepped through the foliage into the clearing.
Basleton saw the Tyrannosaur. No, there were two.
They stood on both sides of a mud mound, two adults, 20 feet high on their hind legs, powerful, dark red, with big, vicious jaws. Like the Mayasaurs, the animals stared at Dodgson for a moment, a dumb stare, as if amazed to see an intruder. And then the Tyrannosaurs roared in fury, an incredible, bellowing, air-shaking roar. Dodgson lifted the box, pointed it at the animals. Immediately, a continuous, high-pitched shriek filled the clearing. The Tyrannosaurs roared in response and lowered their heads, extending their necks forward, snapping their jaws, preparing to attack. They were huge, and they were unaffected by the sound. They started to come around the mound toward Dodgson. The earth shook as they moved.
"Oh, fuck," King said.
But Dodgson stayed cool. He twisted the dial. Basleton clapped his hands over his ears. The shriek became higher, louder, ear-splitting, incredibly painful. The response was immediate. The Tyrannosaurs stepped back as if they had received a physical blow. They ducked their heads. They blinked their eyes rapidly. The sound seemed to vibrate in the air. They roared again, but weakly now, without conviction. A terrible screaming came from inside the mud nest. Dodgson moved forward, pointing the box in the air directly at the animals. The Tyrannosaurs backed away, looking into the nest, then to Dodgson. They swung their heads back and forth rapidly, as if trying to clear their ears. Dodgson calmly adjusted the dial. The sound went higher. It was now excruciating. Dodgson began to climb the mud mound of the nest. Basleton and King scrambled up, following him. Basleton found himself looking down into a nest with 4 mottled white eggs and 2 young babies that looked for all the world like scrawny, oversized turkeys. Anyway, some kind of gigantic baby birds. The 2 Tyrannosaurs were at the far end of the clearing, held away by the sound. Like the Mayasaurs, they urinated in agitation. They stomped their feet, but they did not come closer. Over the ear-splitting shriek of the box, Dodgson shouted, "Get the eggs!" In a daze, King stumbled down into the nest, grabbing the nearest egg. He fumbled it in his shaking hands. The egg flew into the air. He caught it again and lurched back. He stepped on the leg of one of the babies, which screamed in fear and pain. At this, the parents tried to come forward again, drawn by the infant's cries. King hastily clambered out of the nest, ducked away through the foliage. Basleton watched him go. "George!" Dodgson shouted, still aiming the box at the Tyrannosaurs. "Get the other egg!"
Basilton turned to look at the adult tyrannosaurs, seeing their agitation and their anger, watching their jaws snap open and closed, and he had the sudden feeling that, sound or no sound, these animals would not allow anyone to enter the nest again. King had been lucky, but Basilton would not be lucky. He could feel it, and...
George! Now!
Basilton said, I can't.
You dumb fuck.
Holding the gun high, Dodgson began to climb down into the nest himself. But as he started, he twisted his body, and the battery plug pulled out of the box. The sound abruptly died. In the clearing, there was silence. Basilton moaned. The tyrannosaurs shook their heads a final time and roared. Basilton saw Dodgson go rigidly still, his body frozen. Basilton also stood still. Somehow he forced his body to stay where he was. He forced his knees to stop trembling. He held his breath, and he waited. On the far side of the clearing, the tyrannosaurs began to move toward him.
What are they doing? Arby cried in the trailer. He was so close to the monitor his nose almost touched the screen. Are they crazy? They're just standing there.
Beside him, Kelly said nothing. She watched the screen silently.
Want to be out there now, Kel?
Arby said.
Shut up, Kelly said.
No, they're not crazy, Malcolm said over the radio as he stared at the dashboard monitor. The explorer lurched down the trail, heading toward the eastern sector of the island. Thorne was driving. Sarah and Malcolm were in the back seat. Sarah said,
He should be trying to put his sound machine together again. Are they really just going to stand there?
Yes, Malcolm said.
Why?
They are misinformed, Malcolm said. Dodgson. Dodgson watched the lead tyrannosaur come toward him. For such big animals, they were cautious. Only one of the two parents approached them, and although it paused to roar fiercely every few paces, it seemed oddly tentative, as if it was perplexed by the fact that the men were staying there. Or perhaps it could not see them. Perhaps he and Basilton had vanished from their view. The other parent hung back, remaining toward the other side of the nest, bobbing and ducking its head, agitated. Agitated, but not attacking. Of course, the roars of the approaching dinosaur were terrifying, blood-chilling. Dodgson didn't dare glance at Basilton, just a few yards away. Basilton was probably peeing in his pants right now. Just so he didn't turn and run, Dodgson thought. If he ran, he was a dead man. If he stayed perfectly still, everything would be all right. Standing stiffly, keeping his body rigid, Dodgson held the anodized box at waist level in his left hand, near his belt buckle. With his right hand, he slowly, ever so slowly, pulled up the disconnected power cord. In a few moments, he would feel the end plug in his hands, and then he would slip it back into the box. Meanwhile, he never took his eyes off the approaching tyrannosaur. He felt the ground shake beneath his feet. He heard the cries of the infant that King had stepped on. Those cries seemed to bother the parents, to arouse them. No matter. Just a few seconds more, and he would have the plug back in the power pack. And then... The tyrannosaur was very close now. Dodgson could smell the rotten odor of the carnivore. The animal roared, and he felt hot breath. It was standing right by Basilton. Dodgson turned his head fractionally to watch. Basilton stood entirely still. The tyrannosaur came close and lowered his big head. He snorted at Basilton. He raised his head again as if perplexed. He really can't see him, Dodgson thought. The tyrannosaur bellowed, a ferocious sound.
Somehow Basilton stayed unmoving. The Tyrannosaur bent over, bringing his huge head down again. The jaws opened and closed. Basilton stared straight forward, not blinking. With huge flaring nostrils, the Tyrannosaur smelled him, a long snuffling inhalation that fluttered Basilton's trouser legs. Then the Tyrannosaur nudged Basilton tentatively with his snout. And in that moment, Dodgson realized that the animal could see him after all. And then the Tyrannosaur swung his head laterally, striking Basilton in the side and easily knocking him to the earth. Basilton yelled as the Tyrannosaur's big foot came down, pinning him to the ground. Basilton raised his arms and shouted, "You son of a bitch!" just as the head came down, jaws wide and closed on him. The movement was gentle, almost delicate, but in the next instant the head snapped high, tearing the body, and Dodgson heard a scream and saw something small and floppy hanging from the jaws, and realized it was Basilton's arm. Basilton's hand swung freely, the metal band of his wristwatch glinting beneath the Tyrannosaur's huge eye. Basilton was screaming, a continuous, undifferentiated sound, and hearing it, Dodgson broke into a dizzying sweat. Then he turned and ran, back toward the car, back toward safety, back toward anything. He ran. Kelly and Arby turned away from the monitor at the same moment. Kelly felt sick. She couldn't watch. But through the radio, they could still hear the tinny screams of the man lying on his back while the Tyrannosaur tore him apart. "Turn it off," Kelly said. A moment later, the sound stopped. Kelly sighed, let her shoulders drop.
"Thank you," she said.
"I didn't do anything," Arby said. She glanced back at the screen and quickly looked away again. The Tyrannosaur was tearing at something red. She shivered. It was silent in the trailer. Kelly heard the tick of electronic counters and the thumping of the water pumps under the floor. Outside, there was the faint sound of wind rustling the tall grass. Kelly suddenly felt very alone, very isolated on this island.
"Arby," she said, "what are we going to do?"
Arby didn't answer her. He bolted for the bathroom.
"I knew it," Malcolm said, staring at the dashboard monitor. "I knew that would happen. They tried to steal eggs. Now look, the Tyrannosaurs are leaving. Both of them."
He pushed the radio transmitter. "Arby, Kelly, are you there?"
"We can't talk," Kelly said.
The explorer continued down the hillside, toward the area of the Tyrannosaur nest. Thorn gripped the wheel grimly as he drove. "What a damn mess.
Kelly, are you listening? We can't see what's happening down there. The Tyrannosaurs have left the nest. Kelly? What's happening?"
Dodgson sprinted for the Jeep. The battery pack fell off his belt as he ran, but he didn't care. Up ahead in the Jeep, he saw King waiting, tense and pale. Dodgson got behind the wheel, started the engine. The Tyrannosaurs roared.
"Where's Basilton?" King asked.
"Didn't make it," Dodgson said.
"What do you mean?"
"I mean he fucking didn't make it," Dodgson yelled and slammed the car into gear.
The Jeep took off, bouncing up the hill. They heard the Tyrannosaurs bellowing behind them. King was holding the egg, looking back down the road.
"Maybe we should get rid of this," he said.
"Don't you fucking dare," Dodgson said.
King was rolling down the window.
"Maybe he just wants the egg back."
"No," Dodgson said. "No!"
He reached across the passenger seat, struggling with King as he drove. The trail was narrow, with deep ruts. The Jeep lurched forward. Suddenly, one of the Tyrannosaurs burst from the trees in the road ahead. The animal stood there, snarling, blocking the road.
"Oh, Christ," Dodgson said, slamming on the brakes.
The car slid sickeningly in the muddy track, came to a stop. The Tyrannosaur lumbered toward them, bellowing.
"Turn around!" King screamed. "Turn around!"
But Dodgson didn't turn around. He slammed the car into reverse and started backing down the trail. He was driving fast, and the road was narrow.
"You're crazy," King said. "You're gonna kill us."
Dodgson swung his arm, smacked King with his hand.
"Shut the fuck up," he shouted.
It took all his attention to maneuver the car back down the winding trail. Even going as fast as he could, he was sure the Tyrannosaur would be faster. It wasn't going to work. They were in a fucking jeep with a fucking cloth top, and they were going to get killed and...
"No!"
King shouted. Behind them, Dodgson saw the second Tyrannosaur charging up the road toward them. He looked forward, saw the first Tyrannosaur bearing down on them. They were trapped. He twisted the wheel in panic and the car ran off the road, crashing backward into dense underbrush and surrounding trees, and he felt a jolting impact. Then the rear of the car dropped sickeningly, and he realized the back wheels were hanging over the edge of a hill. He gunned the engine frantically, but the wheels just spun in the air. It was hopeless. And slowly, the car sank backward, deeper into foliage so dense he could not see through it. But they were over the edge. Beside him, King was sobbing. He heard the Tyrannosaurs roaring, very near now. Dodgson flung open the car door and jumped out into space. He plunged through the foliage, fell, hit a tree trunk, and tumbled down a steep jungle hill. Somewhere along the way, he felt a sharp pain in his forehead and saw stars for the brief moment before blackness enveloped him and he lost consciousness. Decision. They sat in the Explorer on top of the ridge overlooking the jungle-covered East Valley. The windows were down. They listened to the bellowing of the Tyrannosaurs as the huge animals crashed through the underbrush. "They both left the nest," Thorne said.
"Yeah. Those guys must have taken something."
Malcolm sighed. They were silent a while, listening. They heard a soft buzzing, and then Eddie pulled up alongside them in the motorcycle.
"I thought you might need help. Are you going to go down?"
Malcolm shook his head.
"No,
absolutely not. It's too dangerous. We don't know where they are."
Sarah Harding said,
"Why did Dodgson just stand there like that? That's not the way to act around predators. You get caught around lions, you make a lot of noise, wave your hands, throw things at them. Try to scare them off. You don't just stand there."
"He probably read the wrong research paper," Malcolm said, shaking his head. "There's been a theory going around that Tyrannosaurs can only see movement. A guy named Roxton made casts of Rex brain cases and concluded the Tyrannosaurs had the brain of a frog." The radio clicked. Levine said, "Roxton is an idiot. He doesn't know enough anatomy to have sex with his wife. His paper was a joke."
"What paper?" Thorne said.
The radio clicked again. "Roxton," Levine said, "believed that Tyrannosaurs had a visual system like an amphibian. Like a frog. A frog sees motion but doesn't see stillness. But it is quite impossible that a predator such as a Tyrannosaur would have a visual system that worked that way. Quite impossible. Because the most common defense of prey animals is to freeze. A deer or something like that, it senses danger and it freezes. A predator has to be able to see them anyway. And of course a Tyrannosaur could." Over the radio, Levine snorted with disgust. "It's just like the other idiotic theory put forth by Grant a few years back, that a Tyrannosaur could be confused by a driving rainstorm because it was not adapted to wet climates. That's equally absurd. The Cretaceous wasn't particularly dry. And in any case, Tyrannosaurs are North American animals.
They've only been found in the U.S. or Canada. Tyrannosaurus rex lived on the shores of the Great Inland Sea, east of the Rocky Mountains. There are lots of thunderstorms on mountain slopes. I'm quite sure tyrannosaurs saw plenty of rain, and they evolved to deal with it.
So is there any reason why a tyrannosaur might not attack somebody? Malcolm said.
Yes, of course. The most obvious one, Levine said.
Which is?
If it wasn't hungry. If it had just eaten another animal. Anything larger than a goat would take care of its hunger for hours to come. No, no. The tyrannosaur sees fine, moving or still.
They listened to the roaring coming up from the valley below. They saw thrashing in the underbrush about half a mile away to the north. More bellowing. The two rexes seemed to be answering each other.
Sarah Harding said,
"What are we carrying?"
Thorne said, "3 Lindstrats, fully loaded."
"Okay," she said. "Let's go."
The radio crackled. "I'm not there," Levine said over the radio, "but I'd certainly advise waiting."
"The hell with waiting," Malcolm said.
"Sarah's right. Let's go down there and see how bad it is."
"Your funeral," Levine said.
Arby came back to the monitor, wiping his chin. He still looked a little green.
"What are they doing now?"
"Dr. Malcolm and the others are going to the nest."
"Are you kidding?" he said, alarmed. "Don't worry," Kelly said. "Sarah can handle it."
"You hope," Arby said. Nest. Just beyond the clearing, they parked the Explorer. Eddie pulled up in the motorcycle and leaned it against the trunk of a tree and waited while the others climbed out of the Explorer. Sarah Harding smelled the familiar sour odor of rotting flesh and excrement that always marked a carnivore nesting site. In the afternoon heat, it was faintly nauseating. Flies buzzed in the still air. Harding took one of the rifles, slung it over her shoulder. She looked at the three men. They were all standing very still, tense, not moving. Malcolm's face was pale, particularly around the lips. It reminded her of the time that Kaufman, her old professor, had visited her in Africa. Kaufman was one of those hard-drinking Hemingway types, with lots of affairs at home, and lots of tales of his adventures with the orangs in Sumatra, the ring-tailed lemurs in Madagascar. So she took him with her to a kill site in the savannah, and he promptly passed out. He weighed more than 200 pounds, and she had to drag him out by the collar while the lions circled and snarled at her. It had been a good lesson for her. Now she leaned close to the three men and whispered, "If you've got any qualms about this, don't go. Just wait here. I don't want to worry about you. I can do this myself." She started off.
"Are you sure?"
"Yes. Now keep quiet." She moved directly toward the clearing. Malcolm and the others hurried to catch up with her. She pushed aside the palm fronds and stepped out into the open. The tyrannosaurs were gone, and the mud cone was deserted. Over to the right, she saw a shoe with a bit of torn flesh sticking out above the ragged sock. That was all there was left of Basilton. From within the nest, she heard a plaintive, high-pitched squeal. Harding climbed up the mud bank, with Malcolm struggling to follow. She saw 2 infant tyrannosaurs there, mewling. Nearby were 3 large eggs. They saw heavy footprints all around in the mud. "They took one of the eggs," Malcolm said. "Damn."
"You didn't want anything to disrupt your little ecosystem?"
Malcolm smiled crookedly.
"Yeah, I was hoping."
"Too bad," she said, and moved quickly around the edge of the pit. She bent over, looking at the baby tyrannosaurs. One of the babies was cowering, its downy neck pulled into its body. But the second one behaved very differently.
It did not move as they approached, but remained lying sprawled on its side, breathing shallowly, eyes glazed.
"This one's been hurt," she said.
Levine was standing in the high hide. He pressed the headset to his ear and spoke into the microphone near his cheek.
"I need a description," he said.
Thorne said, "There's two of them, roughly 2 feet long, weighing maybe 40 pounds. About the size of small cassowary birds. Large eyes, short snouts, pale brown color. And there's a ring of down around the necks."
"Can they stand?"
If they can, not very well. They're kind of flopping around, squeaking a lot."
"Then they're infants," Levine said, nodding. "Probably only a few days old. Never been out of the nest.
I'd be very careful."
"Why is that?"
"With offspring that young," Levine said, "the parents won't leave them for long." Harding moved closer to the injured infant. Still mewling, the baby tried to crawl toward her, dragging its body awkwardly. One leg was bent at an odd angle.
"I think the left leg's hurt."
Eddie came closer, standing alongside her to see.
"Is it broken?"
"Yeah, probably, but..."
"Hey!" Eddie said.
The baby lunged forward and clamped its jaws around the ankle of his boot. He pulled his foot away, dragging the baby, which held its grip tightly.
"Hey! Let go!"
Eddie lifted his leg up, shook it back and forth, but the baby refused to let go. He pulled for a moment longer, then stopped. Now the baby just lay there on the ground, breathing shallowly, jaws still locked around Eddie's boot.
"Geez," Eddie said.
"Aggressive little guy, isn't he?" Sarah said. "Right from birth."
Eddie looked down at the tiny, razor-sharp jaws. They hadn't penetrated the leather. The baby held on firmly. With the butt of his rifle, he poked the infant's head a couple of times. It had no effect at all. The baby lay on the ground, breathing shallowly. Its big eyes blinked slowly as they stared up at Eddie, but it did not release its grip. They heard the distant roars of the parents somewhere to the north.
"Let's get out of here," Malcolm said. "We've seen what we came here to see. We've got to find where Dodgson went."
Thorne said, "I think I saw a track up the trail. It might have gone off there."
"We better have a look."
They all started back to the car.
"Wait a minute," Eddie said, looking down at his foot. "What am I going to do about the baby?"
"Shoot it," Malcolm said, over his shoulder.
"You mean kill it?"
Sarah said,
"It's got a broken leg, Eddie. It's going to die anyway."
"Yeah, but..."
Thorne called, "We're going back up the trail, Eddie, and if we don't find Dodgson, we'll take the ridge road going toward the laboratory. Then down to the trailer again."
"Okay, Doc. I'm right behind you."
Eddie lifted his rifle, turned it in his hands. "Do it now," Sarah said, climbing into the Explorer. "Because you don't want to be here when Mama and Papa get back."
Gambler's Ruin. Driving up the trail, Malcolm stared at the dashboard monitor as the image flicked from one camera view to another. He was looking for Dodgson and the rest of his party. Over the radio, Levine said,
"How bad was it?"
"They took one egg," Malcolm said, "and we had to shoot one of the babies."
"So, a loss of 2. Out of a total hatching brood of what, 6?
"That's right."
"Frankly, I'd say it's a minor matter," Levine said, "as long as you stop those people from doing anything more."
"We're looking for them now," Malcolm said morosely. Harding said, "It was bound to happen, Ian. You know you can't expect to observe the animals without changing anything. It's a scientific impossibility."
"Of course it is," Malcolm said. "That's the greatest single scientific discovery of the 20th century. You can't study anything without changing it."
Since Galileo, scientists had adopted the view that they were objective observers of the natural world.
That was implicit in every aspect of their behavior, even the way they wrote scientific papers, saying things like, it was observed, as if nobody had observed it. For 300 years, that impersonal quality was the hallmark of science. Science was objective, and the observer had no influence on the results he or she described. This objectivity made science different from the humanities or from religion, fields where the observer's point of view was integral, where the observer was inextricably mixed up in the results observed. But in the 20th century, that difference had vanished. Scientific objectivity was gone, even at the most fundamental levels. Physicists now knew you couldn't even measure a single subatomic particle without affecting it totally. If you stuck your instruments in to measure a particle's position, you changed its velocity. If you measured its velocity, you changed its position. That basic truth became the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, that whatever you studied, you also changed. In the end, it became clear that all scientists were participants in a participatory universe which did not allow anyone to be a mere observer. I know objectivity is impossible, Malcolm said impatiently. I'm not concerned about that. Then what are you concerned about? I'm concerned about the gambler's ruin, Malcolm said, staring at the monitor. Gambler's ruin was a notorious and much debated statistical phenomenon that had major consequences both for evolution and for everyday life. Let's say you're a gambler, he said, and you're playing a coin toss game. Every time the coin comes up heads, you win a dollar. Every time it comes up tails, you lose a dollar. Okay. What happens over time? Harding shrugged. The chances of getting either heads or tails is even. So maybe you win, maybe you lose. But in the end, you'll come out at zero. Unfortunately, you don't, Malcolm said. If you gamble long enough, you'll always lose. The gambler is always ruined. That's why casinos stay in business. But the question is, what happens over time? What happens in the period before the gambler is finally ruined? Okay, she said. What happens? If you chart the gambler's fortunes over time, what you find is the gambler wins for a period or loses for a period. In other words, everything in the world goes in streaks. It's a real phenomenon, and you see it everywhere. In weather, in river flooding, in baseball, in heart rhythms, in stock markets. Once things go bad, they tend to stay bad. Like the old folks saying that bad things come in threes. Complexity theory tells us the folk wisdom is right. Bad things cluster. Things go to hell together. That's the real world. So what are you saying? That things are going to hell now? They could be, thanks to Dodgson, Malcolm said, frowning at the monitor. What happened to those bastards anyway? King. There was a buzzing, like the sound of a distant bee. Howard King was dimly aware of it as he came slowly back to consciousness. He opened his eyes and saw the windshield of a car and the branches of trees beyond. The buzzing was louder. King didn't know where he was. He couldn't remember how he got here, what had happened. He felt pain in his shoulders and at his hips. His forehead throbbed. He tried to remember, but the pain distracted him, prevented him from thinking clearly. The last thing he remembered was the Tyrannosaur in front of him on the road. That was the last thing. Then Dodgson had looked back and... King turned his head and cried out as sudden, sharp pain ran up his neck to his skull. The pain made him gasp, took his breath away. He closed his eyes, wincing. Then he slowly opened them again. Dodgson was not in the car. The driver's door hung wide open, a dappled shadow across the door panel. The keys were still in the ignition. Dodson was gone. There was a streak of blood across the top of the steering wheel. The black box was on the floor by the gear shift. The open driver's door creaked a little, moved a little. In the distance, King heard the buzzing again, like a giant bee. It was a mechanical sound, he now realized. Something mechanical. It made him think of the boat. How long would the boat wait at the river? What time was it anyway? He looked at his watch. The crystal was smashed, the hands fixed at 1:54. He heard the buzzing again. It was coming closer. With an effort, King pushed himself away from the seat, toward the dashboard. Streaks of electric pain shot up his spine, but quickly subsided. He took a deep breath. I'm all right, he thought. At least, I'm still here. King looked at the open driver's door in the sunlight. The sun was still high. It must still be sometime in the afternoon. When was the boat leaving? 4 o'clock? 5 o'clock? He couldn't remember anymore. But he was certain that those Spanish fishermen wouldn't hang around once it started to get dark. They'd leave the island. And Howard King wanted to be on the boat when they did. It was the only thing he wanted in the world. Wincing, he raised himself up and painfully slid over to the driver's seat. He settled himself in, took a deep breath, and then leaned over and looked out the open door. The car was hanging over empty space, supported by trees. He saw a steep jungle hillside falling away beneath him. It was dark beneath the canopy of trees. He felt dizzy just looking down. The ground must be 20 or 30 feet below him. He saw scattered green ferns and a few dark boulders. He twisted his body to look more. And then he saw him. Dodson lay on his back, head downward on the slope of the hill. His body was crumpled, arms and legs thrown out in awkward positions. He was not moving. King couldn't see him very well in the dense foliage on the hillside, but Dodson looked dead. The buzzing was suddenly very loud, building rapidly, and King looked forward and saw, through the foliage that blocked the windshield, a car driving by, not 10 yards away. A car. And then the car was gone. From the sound of it, he thought, it was an electric car. So it must be Malcolm. Howard King was somehow encouraged by the thought that other people were on this island. He felt new strength, despite the pain in his body. He reached forward and turned the key in the ignition. The engine rumbled. He put the car in gear and gently stepped on the accelerator. The rear wheels spun. He engaged the front-wheel drive. At once, the Jeep rumbled forward, lurching through the branches. A moment later, he was out on the road. He remembered this road now. To the right, it led down to the Tyrannosaurus nest. Malcolm's car had gone to the left. King turned left and headed up the road. He was trying to remember how to get back to the river, back to the boat. He vaguely recalled that there was a Y-fork in the road at the top of the hill. He would take that fork, he decided, drive down the hill, and get the hell off this island. That was his only goal. To get off this island before it was too late. Bad news. The explorer came to the top of the hill, and Thorne drove onto the ridge road. The road curved back and forth, cut into the rock face of the cliff. In many places, the drop-off was precipitous, but they had views over the entire island. Eventually, they came to a place where they could look over the valley. They could see the high hide off to the left, and closer by, the clearing with the two trailers. Off to the right was the laboratory complex, and the worker complex beyond. I don't see Dodgson anywhere, Malcolm said unhappily. Where could he have gone? Thorne pushed the radio button. Arby?
Yes, Doc.
Do you see them?
No, but... He hesitated.
What?
Don't you want to come back here now? It's pretty amazing.
What is? Thorne said.
Eddie, Arby said.
He just got back.
And he brought the baby with him.
Malcolm leaned forward.
He did what?
Fifth configuration. At the edge of chaos, unexpected outcomes occur. The risk to survival is severe. Ian Malcolm. Baby. In the trailer, they were clustered around the table where the baby Tyrannosaurus Rex now lay unconscious on a stainless steel pan, his large eyes closed, his snout pushed into the clear plastic oval of an oxygen mask. The mask almost fitted the baby's blunt snout. The oxygen hissed softly.
I couldn't just leave him, Eddie said, and I figured we can fix his leg.
But Eddie, Malcolm said, shaking his head. So I shot him full of morphine from the first aid kit and brought him back. You see? The oxygen mask almost fits him.
Eddie, Malcolm said, this was the wrong thing to do.
Why? He's okay. We just fix him and take him back.
But you're interfering with the system, Malcolm said.
The radio clicked.
This is extremely unwise, Levine said over the radio. Extremely.
Thank you, Richard, Thorne said.
I am entirely opposed to bringing any animal back to the trailer.
Too late to worry about that now, Sarah Harding said. She had moved forward alongside the baby and began strapping cardiac leads to the animal's chest. They heard the thump of the heartbeat. It was very fast, over 150 beats a minute.
How much morphine did you give him?
Gee, Eddie said. I just, you know, the whole syringe.
What is that? 10 cc's?
I think. Maybe 20. Malcolm looked at Harding. How long before it wears off?
I have no idea, she said.
I've sedated lions and jackals in the field when I tagged them. With those animals, there's a rough correlation between dose and body weight. But with young animals, it's unpredictable. Maybe a few minutes, maybe a few hours. And I don't know a thing about baby tyrannosaurs. Basically, it's a function of metabolism, and this one seems to be rapid, bird-like. The heart's pumping very fast. All I can say is, let's get him out of here as quickly as possible.
Harding picked up the small ultrasound transducer and held it to the baby's leg. She looked over her shoulder at the monitor. Kelly and Arby were blocking the view.
Please, give us a little room here, she said, and they moved away.
We don't have much time. Please.
As they moved away, Sarah saw the green and white outlines of the leg and its bones.
Surprisingly like a large bird, she thought. A vulture or a stork.
She moved the transducer.
Okay. There's the metatarsals. And there's the tibia and fibula, the two bones of the lower leg.
Arby said, why are the bones different shades like that?
The legs had some dense white sections within paler green outlines.
Because it's an infant, Harding said. His legs are still mostly cartilage, with very little calcified bone. I'd guess this baby probably can't walk yet. At least, not very well.
There. Look at the patella. You can see the blood supply to the joint capsule.
How come you know all this anatomy? Kelly said.
I have to. I spent a lot of time looking through the scat of predators, she said, examining pieces of bones that are left behind and figuring out which animals have been eaten. To do that, you have to know comparative anatomy very well. She moved the transducer along the baby's leg. And my father was a vet. Malcolm looked up sharply.
Your father was a vet?
Yes. At the San Diego Zoo. He was a bird specialist. But I don't see... Can you magnify this?
Arby flicked a switch. The image doubled in size.
Ah, okay. All right, there it is. You see it?
No.
It's mid-fibula. See it? A thin black line. That's a fracture, just above the epiphysis.
That little black line there, Arby said.
That little black line means death for this infant, Sarah said. The fibula won't heal straight, so the ankle joint can't pivot when he stands on his hind feet. The baby won't be able to run and probably can't even walk. It'll be crippled, and a predator will pick it off before it gets more than a few weeks old.
Eddie said, but we can set it.
Okay, Sarah said. What were you going to use for a cast?
Diesterase, Eddie said. I brought a kilo of it in 100cc tubes. I packed lots for glue. The stuff's polymer resin. It solidifies hard as steel.
Great, Harding said. That'll kill him, too.
It will?
He's growing, Eddie. In a few weeks, he'll be much larger. We need something that's rigid but biodegradable, she said. Something that will wear off or break off in 3 to 5 weeks when his legs healed. What have you got?
Eddie frowned.
I don't know. Well, we haven't got much time, Harding said.
Eddie said, Doc,
this is like one of your famous test questions. How to make a dinosaur cast with only Q-tips and superglue?
I know, Thorne said. The irony of the situation was not lost on him. He had given problems such as these to his engineering students for 3 decades. Now he was faced with one himself.
Eddie said, maybe we could degrade the resin. Mix it with something like table sugar.
Thorne shook his head.
Hydroxy groups in the sucrose will make the resin friable. It'll harden okay, but it'll shatter like glass as soon as the animal moves.
What if we mix it with cloth that's been soaked in sugar?
You mean to get bacteria to decay the cloth?
Yeah.
And then the cast breaks?
Yeah.
Thorne shrugged.
That might work, he said.
But without testing, we can't know how long the cast will last. Might be a few days, it might be a few months.
That's too long, Sarah said. This animal is growing rapidly. If growth is constricted, it'll end up being crippled by the cast.
What we need, Eddie said, is an organic resin that will form a decaying binder, like a gum of some kind.
Chewing gum? Arby said. Because I have plenty of...
No, I was thinking of a different kind of gum.
Chemically speaking, the diesterase resin...
We'll never solve it chemically, Thorne said. We don't have the supplies.
What else can we do?
There's no choice, but...
What if you make something that's different in different directions, Arby said. Strong one way and weak in another.
You can't, Eddie said. It's a homogeneous resin. It's all the same stuff. Goopy glue that turns rock hard when it dries and...
No.
Wait a minute, Thorne said, turning to the boy. What do you mean, Arby?
Well,
Arby said, Sarah said the leg is growing. That means it's going to grow longer, which doesn't matter for a cast, and wider, which does, because it'll start to squeeze the leg. But if you made it weak in the diameter...
He's right, Thorne said.
We can solve it structurally.
How? Eddie said.
Just build in a split line. Maybe using aluminum foil. We have some for cooking.
That'd be much too weak, Eddie said.
Not if we coat it with a layer of resin.
Thorne turned to Sarah.
What we can do is make a cast that is very strong for vertical stresses, but weak for lateral stresses. It's a simple engineering problem. The baby can walk around on its cuff and everything is fine as long as the stresses are vertical.
but when its leg grows, it will pop the split line open, and the cuff will fall away.
Yes, Arby said, nodding.
Is that hard to do?
She said.
No. It should be pretty easy.
You just build a cuff of aluminum foil and coat it with resin.
Eddie said, and what'll hold the cuff together while you coat it?
How about chewing gum? Arby said.
You got it, Thorne said, smiling. At that moment, the baby Rex stirred, its legs twitching. It raised its head, the oxygen mask dropping away, and gave a low, weak squeak.
Quickly, Sarah said, grabbing the head.
More morphine. Malcolm had a syringe ready. He jabbed it into the animal's neck.
Just 5 cc's now, Sarah said.
What's wrong with more? Keep him out longer.
He's in shock from the injury, Ian. You can kill him with too much morphine. You'll put him into respiratory arrest. His adrenal glands are probably stressed, too.
If he even has adrenals, Malcolm said. Does a Tyrannosaurus rex have hormones at all? The truth is, we don't know anything about these animals.
The radio clicked, and Levine said, "Speak for yourself, Ian. In point of fact, I suspect we will find that dinosaurs have hormones. There are compelling reasons to imagine they do. As long as you have gone to the misguided trouble of taking the baby, you might draw some tubes of blood. Meanwhile, Doc, could you pick up the phone?"